This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida lawmakers passed an $89 billion budget last weekend. And that budget is money for affordable housing. But advocates say it's not enough. They're not happy that millions of dollars in the Housing Trust Fund was swept into other projects. Well, joining me to explain how the Trust Fund works is Jamie Ross. She's the CEO of the Florida Housing Coalition. It's a non-profit which is dedicated to promoting affordable housing. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
First of all, the money we're talking about, more than $300 million, comes out of something called the Sadowski Trust Fund. Just remind our listeners what that is and why it was set up.
Sure. The Sadowski Affordable Housing Trust Fund came from a bill that passed in 1992, creating a dedicated revenue source for affordable housing in Florida. It's a small amount of the documentary stamp tax that's paid when you record deeds. And that money goes directly into two different trust funds. One is the State Housing Trust Fund. The other is the Local Government Housing Trust Fund. Most people know about the Local Government Housing Trust Fund by its name, SHIP. The State Housing Trust Fund, which is administered by the Florida Housing Finance Corporation, most people refer to that as SAIL.
So how was that money allocated to those programs?
So it's by operation of law. When the act passed in 1992, by the way, it was supported overwhelmingly. It was a bipartisan effort supported by the realtors, the builders, the League of Cities, Association of Counties, legal services, and so on. That coalition, by the way, now is up to 30 statewide organizations, includes organizations like the Florida Chamber of Commerce. So it's really an amazingly diverse coalition of interests that's got together and said, let's tax our industry, the housing industry. We're going to raise the documentary stamp tax on all deeds by a dime, and then that money is going to go directly into these trust funds. But the money does have to be appropriated out every year in a budget bill. And sometimes that's confusing to people. It's like, well, wait a second. I thought we passed this act and we have this money that's meant specifically for affordable housing. How is it that we're not getting that money back? And the reason is because the money does still have to be appropriated in a budget bill every year. Now, the first 10 years of the program, from 1992 until 2002, all the money that was collected was appropriated back the way it was supposed to. And when you talk about the majority of the funds, it goes to the SHIP program. 70% of the money go to local governments through the SHIP program. It goes on a population-based formula. And so the first 10 years of the program, it worked exactly as it was intended. The money dropped into the trust funds, the legislature appropriated it back out, and the money was distributed back to the local level to the SHIP program. The state money was administered at the state level for the SAIL program, which is a competitive program that developers apply for. But it's been 15 years now that the legislature has not been appropriating all the money that's in the trust funds. And so unfortunately what we have is virtually no legislators in Tallahassee have ever seen the trust fund working properly. So it almost becomes a question each year, well, how much money are you asking for? Instead of realizing we're asking for all of the money that's in the housing trust funds. That's what a trust fund is. All of the money that's in the trust fund is supposed to be appropriated for housing. But unfortunately, it's really become a bit of a piggy bank for the legislature to look to fund whatever their priorities are that particular session. So we still get an enormous amount of money for affordable housing compared, let's say, to other states who don't have a dedicated revenue source, but it's nothing close to where it should be. So this year, for instance, it's about a third of what it should be. So the total housing appropriation this year is $123.6 million. But the money that was available was $322 million. So you can see how much was swept for other purposes. And this year, what you heard in the last part of the legislative session was that it was in because of the need to find $400 million to respond to the tragedy shooting in Parkland.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking to Jamie Ross, the CEO of the Florida Housing Coalition. So would $322 million even have been enough for affordable housing in Florida, or could you have used more?
Sure. It's a terrific amount of money to help, but I think everybody knows that we have an enormous housing crisis in the state of Florida. In fact, we mostly don't even talk about the housing crisis anymore because it's just common knowledge. So yes, every penny would have been used, and in fact, you could use more. And especially in an area like yours, where your listeners are, there is a tremendous housing crisis. Even before, for instance, the influx of the evacuees from Puerto Rico, who have mostly come through Central Florida, exacerbating the need for affordable housing in your communities. Basically, there's virtually no rentals open at this point in Central Florida. It's a really dire situation. So yes, all of this money could be used.
You mentioned the SHIP program and the SAIL program. What about the Hurricane Housing Recovery Program and the Rental Recovery Loan Program?
Sure. Well, actually, those programs are not new. We had those programs stood up when we had this series of hurricanes in 04, 05. And basically, they would have been a way to get this money specifically geared to the communities that were hardest hit by the hurricanes. So that would have been Miami-Dade, Monroe County, Collier County. You know, there's like 10 counties that were really hit hard, physically hit hard by the hurricanes. And so that money, that would have been our state money that would be directed to those areas. The fact is that the federal government is sending a substantial amount of money to Florida through the CDBG Disaster Relief, CDBGDR is what it's referred to. The appropriation's already been made by Congress of over $600 million. So there will be federal assistance going to the areas that were hardest hit by the hurricanes. So I wouldn't consider it a loss, especially in your area, that those two programs weren't stood up this legislative session. Actually may have resulted in Central Florida actually getting less money than it gets under the regular formula for SHIP and SAIL. So right now, with the amount of money that was appropriated with this session that just ended, Orange County is going to be getting about $1.8 million, Osceola County a little over $500,000 in SHIP money that'll come directly to your communities.
But as we were saying before, affordable housing advocates, including the Florida Housing Coalition, were hoping for more at the start of the session, right?
Yeah, a lot more. The whole amount, $322.1 million. That's right.
So how do you decide how that money is dispersed? Is there a lobbying process once the money is appropriated?
No, there's not. It's actually by population. So that's why I'm able to actually give you the number. That's why I can tell you what Orange County, what Osceola County will be getting in this next fiscal year in 18-19, because it's population-based. So it's not competitive. That's for the SHIP program. The SAIL program is competitive. That's why I can't tell you how much will or won't be coming in your area. That depends on developers making application for it.
And how much money is going into the SAIL program?
The SAIL program is 79.18. Now, there was this legislative session out of the SAIL money, well, out of the amount of money that goes to Florida Housing Finance Corporation. It's actually $15 million of that has to be used for the Keys. So that was specifically to address all that's happened in the Keys with the storm. Also, there are other, you know, a couple of other smaller items. But generally, that's the amount that's going to be going to SAIL.
Well, back to the issue of the Sadowski Trust Fund. There was some legislation this year to try and protect that fund. How did that come about?
Yes, that's really exciting. And I hope to see that go much farther next session. We had a Republican senator from Collier County, from Naples, Senator Pasadomo, who is an attorney. And she filed legislation to stop the sweeps of the trust funds. I mentioned that she's an attorney because I heard more than once her explaining that as an attorney, she's got trust funds for clients and she knows that she can't use the money that's in the trust fund for a purpose that it isn't there for somebody else. So she did file a bill to stop the sweeps. We were not able to get any traction on the House side for the bill that was to stop the sweeps on the House side because, you know, it was pretty clear from the beginning of session that the House did not intend to use the housing trust fund money for housing. The Senate did. When the Senate came out with its budget at the beginning of the session, they had all the money that's in the housing trust fund appropriated for housing. What we ended up with was the Senate taking the House position. And the explanation that the Senate gave was because they needed to find $400 million for the Parkland to respond to the Parkland tragedy. So the Senate started the session with two things: a bill filed by Senator Pasadomo to stop the sweeps, and a budget to use all the housing trust fund monies, all $322.1 million, for housing. So we started the session off very strong in the Senate.
Jamie Ross, aside from filing legislation to try and protect that Sadowski Trust Fund, is it time to completely rethink the way the fund is treated?
Well, what we have set up, the Sadowski Act, the way it works, the creation of a dedicated revenue source, and the programs, the way they're used, they're just excellent. I mean, this is landmark legislation that's a national model. There's just no doubt about that. In fact, there's been more than one commission set up to review these programs, and they always come out saying these are terrific programs. This money is highly leveraged, extremely well administered. They're just great. So I would not suggest for a minute that we change that. But I do understand, and there's plenty of it, believe me, especially after this session, the feeling that what we've got to do something more. We've got to get louder. We've got to do something more. So I think we have a lot of urgency behind getting those Stop the Sweep bills next year. But I think everybody also realizes, well, what's the reason? Why are we having such a problem in the House? Well, it's the priorities of leadership in the House and the fact that most all of the House members follow leadership. So in 2018, in November, every House member is up for election. Every House member is up for election. So this is a time for all housing advocates, and there are millions of housing advocates in the state of Florida. This is a time for them to make affordable housing a campaign issue. And that's, I think, going to be one of the first things that happens now that session is over and people will be looking to those November elections. It isn't that Florida doesn't have the money. It's just a matter of priorities. And it's not a matter of there being any constituency that doesn't want the housing trust fund monies to be used for housing. It's not like we have anybody on the other side saying, oh, no, no, don't use that money for housing. Use it for something else. We don't have that. So it's just a matter of having a more effective campaign with the legislature.
Jamie Ross is the CEO of the Florida Housing Coalition. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Still to come on Intersection.
In the past, we just kind of leave each other alone, or was like, she's going through stuff. She has her own issues. But now we can see, hey, maybe she needs a hug. Maybe she needs to talk about it. Even as adults, we have to remember that we need those important connections as well.
We visit a Pine Hills childcare center where staff are trying a new technique to help them better relate to the kids and each other. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Regina Tier says running a childcare centre is stressful, but she says it's not a whole day stress, rather a series of moments. The secret, she says, is not letting those moments get the better of you. From the education desk this week, how Regina Tier is using a grant-funded pilot program called Circle of Security to help her staff meet the emotional and social needs of the kids at the centre. We visited Bay's childcare centre in Pine Hills and spoke to Tier and other stakeholders. The conversation began with UCF Associate Professor of Psychology Kimberly Rank, who is leading the research on the pilot program.
The program that we're using here at Bay's childcare centre and also at Admired Angels up the street is called Circle of Security. It originally was conceptualized as a parenting program that teaches caregivers about attachment and how to best capture attachment in their relationships with their young children. So to adapt it here, we wanted to use it in the child care center in each of the classrooms so that our child care providers who have children most of the day throughout the day could use those same tenets of attachment in their interactions in the classroom.
How does it work from a practical perspective? Like, what are some of the things you have to do to make this program work?
Well, what we did is we took all of the child care teachers here at Bays and also at Admired Angels through an 8-week program. It's a DVD-based interactive program that teaches them about attachment, gives them a map in which they can think about how children act. So we talk about kids going out to explore and coming in to have their needs met. And then we use consultation through the remainder of a year period to consult with teachers to see how that was working for them in their classrooms. So we really were shaping teachers' behavior and their interaction style to really foster the socio and emotional development of the young children in their classrooms.
So what kind of results do you see from something like this?
It has been an extraordinary experience to watch these teachers, especially here at Bays, where we are today. They have done such an extraordinary job. They've made a clear distinction between how they used to interact with the young children in their classrooms, and now they're talking a lot more about being connected to them, being able to use the children's behavior as a means of communication to try and understand what the children are needing and how to have their safety needs met. So it's been extraordinary to see. Everybody here who's participated in the program has done just a wonderful job in adopting the program.
Regina Teer, if I could bring you into this conversation. So you've done the training, you're starting to roll this program out. How does it feel to implement this, and what sort of issues is it going to help resolve down the track?
How does it feel? It felt great coming from an educator of young children to take a program meant for parents to help us understand, like she said, the attachments, what's needed, how to meet those needs, and how to implement them in our classroom, in our center. Do I see it working? Yes. I think as a center, we grew as a team. We are all on the same page. We all try to implement the same issues, ideas, thoughts, needs. We all try to work together. We help each other, and we learn from each other.
So how many kids do you have at this daycare center?
Right now, I believe we have 42 enrolled.
Is that sort of fairly large on the spectrum of daycare centers around Orlando?
We are considered a small center here, especially in this area. Our capacity is 57. However, I don't think since we've been open, we've never hit it. So for us to have 42 kids here into what I consider a small space every day, it gets a little crazy. It gets a little hectic. You got some crying. You got some temperaments. You have the teachers who may be having a bad day, and we just have to help each other, and we work the circle now. In the past, we just kind of leave each other alone, or was like, she's going through stuff, she has her own issues. But now we can see, hey, maybe she needs a hug. Maybe she needs to talk about it. Even as adults, we have to remember that we need those important connections as well. We need to know how to express ourselves, how to manage our emotions, and just how to get along with other people. And I think the circle did that for us.
Is it stressful running a daycare center or teaching kids this young?
Most days, yes. But it's not a whole day stress, it's like a moment. And the circle helped us figure out how to not let the moments get the better of us, how to work the moments to our advantage, and just how to smooth the moments so that we don't have an chaotic uproar of crying and disgruntled employees and unhappy people.
So if you've got 42 kids, and as you say, this is on the smaller side for a daycare center, you must get to know the kids fairly well.
A lot of our kids have been here from crib to VPK. So we're family-based. A lot of the kids are family or have been somebody from this center, either went here, worked here, brought somebody here before. So we all know each other personally. And that helps because, again, coming from the parental training part of it, it helped us to understand and implement and not be so much just as a teacher or a daycare worker. We actually became caregivers and nurturers and supporters to not only the kids but the moms as well.
And I guess for any daycare, kids spend a long time there, right? So they're most of their daylight hours are spent with somebody who isn't their parent. So I guess that makes a program like this all the more important.
Absolutely, because we are the secondary parent, because even though we didn't birth them, we are the ones nurturing them, feeding them, teaching them, loving them, just giving them anything that we could think of that they need, anything that they ask for, emotional support, everything.
And does the program help you as well? I mean, speaking of emotional support, who's your backstop? Who kind of helps you deal with some of these moments, as you say?
In the beginning, it was kind of hard to acknowledge that I had the moments because I was superwoman and I was just doing everything, whatever needed, just to take the stress off everybody else. I was trying to make everything work. But then I met Dr. Neil and Dr. Rink. Kim and Neil, and he helped me as he came out and started observing us on the second half of the program. He was like, just stop. Slow down. What do you need? And I'm like, I don't know, because nobody ever asked me. What do you need? So I learned to not only figure out what I need, if I need to step away for a moment, or I also learned to go to my staff and say, hey, do you need help? Do you need a hug? Do you need a break? What do you need? So it helped me. It helped us grow together and become more united as a team. So instead of just the baby teacher or the toddler teacher, we're teachers, we're nurturers, we are a school.
Well, if I could bring you into this conversation, Leslie Hartog, co-chair of 100 Women Strong, how does your organization fit into this pilot program?
100 Women Strong is a women's giving circle and an initiative of the Central Florida Foundation. And what we do is we're a group of women and we contribute a set amount of money each year. And then we work together to talk to the experts in the community about where we want our money to go. And so we grant to benefit women and children's initiatives and issues in the community. And so what we decided 2 years ago, we would focus for 2 years on early childhood because we focus on women and children's issues, but also because we felt like this was really where it all starts. So many of the issues in the community, whether it's kindergarten readiness or graduation rates or career readiness or incarceration rates, all of those kinds of things start with at a very young age. And so we really felt like it was important to focus our money and our efforts in this important time. Mm-hmm. And so we worked with the Early Learning Coalition and with UCF and other partners in the community to decide to do this initiative.
So you all are funding this program?
We funded it the first year, and we called it the feasibility study because, as I think Dr. Rank said, it's a proven model but has never been done in a preschool setting before. And so we wanted to – we like to – look at innovative solutions when we try to solve a problem. And so we felt like it was proven in other areas, but we really wanted to give it some seed money so we could prove it out here in the daycare setting. And so this year, this is our second year of issuing the grant. We also have another funder through the Early Learning Coalition to do an actual pilot and to expand it to other locations and to really prove it out so that then we can go leverage with other funders and expand it even more.
How much does it cost for the pilot and for what you all did in the first year as well?
The first year, I believe it was around $35,000 that we put up for the seed money. And then this year it was $45,000. And then the Early Learning Coalition actually is contributing more than that to make it work. So it's been, $135,000 or so over the 2 years.
If it works and if it has real results as far as, you know, giving people a better head start and cutting off some problems maybe down the track, are you reaching out to, say, businesses and other organizations, nonprofits, to say, look, here's something that can work, here's a good way for you all to spend some of your charitable giving?
Yeah, that's a great point. We really believe in collaborations and what's called collective giving or collective impact. So I think once we can prove it and tell a really good story as to look what it's done in these locations, then we'll be looking to expand it anymore and bring other partners, especially businesses that are interested in taking a leadership role in education, because many businesses believe in how important that is. And so I think that this tells a great story and we'll have a lot of people that want to contribute and invest in this initiative.
So Cindy Jury, you're the Director of Research and Special Projects at the Early Learning Coalition of Orange County. How did you first find out about this program and what made the organization want to get involved?
Well, I first heard about the Circle Security program when I was in my doctoral program and heard about it described as a parenting program. And so it was really exciting when 100 Women Strong reached out to the coalition and a number of other community partners to have a discussion about what could we do around social-emotional development in young children. And as we looked further at it, it was decided to look at this project. We brought a group of early childhood providers from Pine Hills together, had discussion, and from that, Bays and Admired Angels mm-hmm. were selected as the two partners to go forward with this project. Mm-hmm. And as far as the coalition's concerned, we're very interested in seeing that our early childhood programs in Orange County receive as much support as possible, because we know when teachers and children have strong relationships, that enhances the likelihood that children will be entering kindergarten truly ready to learn, because the first 3 to 5 years of life is really the foundation of, you know, a child's sense of trust in the world. So we saw this project as having some enormous potential. We really are interested in seeing if it can be replicated and are just thrilled that UCF is our collaborative partner with this project, because that way we will have research results that we can use to hopefully expand this program further.
At what point does it stop being a pilot project and become something that you can roll out to other early learning centers?
We look for the first couple of years. The Early Learning Coalition, because we're the largest county, urban county in the state of Florida that does not have a Children's Services Council to help provide additional funding to support children's services, our Early Learning Coalition has really made a point of seeking out pilots to see what works. And we start small, we see what needs to be, you know, like tweaked, and then are able to, after a couple of years of seeing how to make it the best possible model, can take it out to a larger scale to support more of our programs.
Do parents see something like this happening and say, I want to try this in my own family?
Absolutely. We have been using Circle, and when I say we, my colleague Neil Boris and I first started using Circle Security in Orlando at places like Aspire through their women's residential program with moms who are substance involved. We also are using it in community-based care, so our child welfare and court-involved parents. And it gives them something extra. We know that lots of families in parts of Orlando, like Pine Hills, have high risk, they have high needs, they have really tricky backgrounds with lots of trauma. And a program like Circle is able to impart the interaction needs that are needed, but also to get the caregivers starting to think about things that have happened to them and how that's spilling over in their interactions with the young children that they have in tow, whether they're parents or caregivers. And so it kind of wraps that all together into a nice package, and you're able to start to address all of those pieces at one time.
Regina Tia, back to you for a moment. How much of a change was it for you and your staff to take this mode of caring for these kids? Was it a big sort of mental jump you had to make?
Not really, because again, being a smaller center, we were already kind of doing it, because we are all some of these kids got. We are the only emotional support. This is the only social setting that they get. So, and all of us are moms, and we've all had kids, so it wasn't like, oh my God, this is a struggle, I don't understand it. It was just learning how to be a little bit more open, a little bit more receptive, and actually saying to the parents, you know what, this works for us, why don't you try it too? So getting everybody on the same page might have been the hardest part, but once we were there and even getting our parents to come in, that made a big difference.
I'm sure if the parents are using something similar at home, it's going to make it easier for you all dealing with your kids at the childcare center.
Yes, sir. But everybody's not willing to try new stuff. So we have those parents who, again, they'll see at one point the child was not exactly happy to come in the door, and it was nothing here or there. It was just their transition. That's what Dr. Neil taught me to say, their transition from the car to the center. So when we would say to the parents, hey, we would go out, instead of just standing here, we would go out and say, hey, come here, let me help you. Walk in with me, let me show you what to do to transition him from the car to the child care center. Mm-hmm. And then it got to the point, the kids were like, okay, bye, Mom. And they're like, well, wait. But they knew they were welcome here, they were supported here, and they had a chance to be who they wanted to be, and there was no judgment.
Yeah, sending your kids off to child care is sometimes a lot tougher on the parents than the kids, isn't it?
Unfortunately, sir, in this area, it's more that the parents are distracted about outside things, phones, cell phones, whatever happened before they got here, and it transferred that negative energy to the children. And then the child is having a moment, so they're just like, oh, take them. And how do you start your day if that's the first thing you hear, if that's the first thing that happens? So here we are again. Come here. Let's talk about it. What can I do? What can I give you? So as long as they know that someone is there with a hug or open arms, I saw the difference in the transitions.
Well, Regina Teer, Director of Bay's Child Care Centre, thank you so much for your time.
You're quite welcome.
Also joined by Cindy Jury, Director of Research and Special Projects at the Early Learning Coalition of Orange County. Thank you so much, Cindy.
Thank you.
And Kimberly Rink, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Central Florida. Kimberly, thank you as well.
Thank you so much for your attention to this issue.
And Leslie Hartog, co-chair of 100 Women Strong. Leslie, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Still to come.
If they want it to be ultra safe, we can, you know, you can put in things like gunshot detection and have that sort of automatically close down or lock down a building if a sensor picks up on those things.
Planners and engineers envisage a future where the Internet of Things leads to safer, greener cities. A conversation about smart and sustainable cities when Intersection continues. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Imagine a city where buildings consume no energy, sensors in the streetlights alert the police if they hear gunshots, and connected cars are wired to prevent crashes. Engineers, planners, and educators will focus on how technology is shaping the city of the future at the Smart and Sustainable Cities Collaborative Roundtable at Rollins College tomorrow evening. Well, joining me in the studio is Yog Melwani. He's the president of the Indian American Chamber of Commerce. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Matthew. Appreciate the invitation.
We're also joined by Methil Hall. She is on the leadership committee with the Chamber. Thank you, Methil.
Thank you.
And Mike Hess, he's the Vice President of Smart and Sustainable Buildings with Panasonic. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
So what is a smart and sustainable city?
So there's a lot of different definitions on what a smart city is, but just simply put, it's using the Internet of Things and digital technology to improve the quality of life of our citizens.
Can you give me some examples of what those Internet of Things might be that would make your life better?
Yes, I can. And I actually think that Mike's going to have some really good examples on that as well. So there's a lot of different areas and sectors that folks and communities focus on for smart cities. So people, livability, mobility, economy, the environment. So here in Orlando, a big effort is focused on transportation. So autonomous vehicles is one area of focus here and an example.
And that's something that's being developed and worked on at the moment, right? And I know some people might have some concerns about autonomous vehicles, but I mean, there are other things where there's like smart technology that's built into things we might use every day and we're not even aware of, right?
There's tons of examples. Some of it is surrounding safety and security. So if we're even just talking about police force, so I know there's some testing with smart streetlights where based off of a decibel level of using artificial intelligence, if you hear something at a certain decibel level might be triggered as a gunshot, so it'll ping the police station.
So there's a sensor in the streetlight that is listening for things.
They are working on that now, yeah. What's interesting, too, so also on that safety and security standpoint, I mean, I know in the U.S. privacy is really important, but, you know, other countries around the world have different focuses. Some are overlapped, but, for example, in China, I went to China last fall, into Yinchuan, and claiming to be the smartest city in the world. And they had some interesting facial recognition pieces there, too, where your face is essentially your bank account. So you walk up to the bus, they do a facial scan, and it just charges your bank account for that pass. So you don't have to really carry money.
Are people worried about that, though? I mean, that seems like something people might be a little bit concerned about here in the United States, if not in China or wherever else.
Yeah, I mean, I think the culture and the government functionings are very different. So that's why there's a cultural element to.
I want to turn back to you, Yog, and ask, you know, since we're talking about smart initiatives in other countries, there is an initiative happening in India. And I guess that's the sort of tie-in with the Indian American Chamber of Commerce here. There's a link to what's going on in India and that country's plans to develop some more smart and sustainable technology that can be rolled out in cities there.
Absolutely. The reason why the Indian American Chamber of Commerce got involved in this conversation is because Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India launched an initiative a few years ago to have 100 smart cities in India in the next few years. So they're already working on the technologies, resources, and the tie-in with us is from a business perspective, because we're a chamber of commerce and we connect people and foster business, we wanted to launch this initiative to provide our membership the opportunity to learn about this new industry and be able to facilitate some commerce, some international trade, share some resources, best practices that are currently available in India.
Okay, well, let me turn back to you then, Mike Hess, VP of Smart and Sustainable Buildings with Panasonic. What does Panasonic do to develop some of these technologies, and what are some of the things that you're working on that we might not see just yet, but around the corner?
I would actually say the first sort of misconception with smart cities and smart buildings is that it doesn't really start with technology. So our focus really starts with stakeholder alignment and just good old-fashioned planning. So a lot of the problems that we have are not technology problems, they're business case problems. And trying to get different departments, private developers, bus service, and all those people to work together. And then we start to understand how we use technology to fill in the gaps. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the technologies we're focused on are connected vehicle platforms, so that in a couple of years when your new car can actually start to communicate with the rest of the world, that there's a platform to accept that data and use that data. And those types of platforms are all about eliminating traffic deaths. We're very focused on the energy technology side, batteries, clean power, and really pushing towards trying to create the business models through stakeholder alignment and technology so that all buildings, all cities can be 100% clean, resilient energy at all times.
Is there such a thing as an energy neutral building right now?
Yeah, there are some net zero energy, carbon neutral buildings. We Panasonic are trying to push that to the next level on a development in Denver that we're part landowner on, where we're trying to make an entire 400-acre neighborhood carbon neutral.
And is something like that happening here in Orlando too? Like, do you see some opportunities for this city? Are there some opportunities you can see here in Central Florida for something similar?
Oh, absolutely. And the city of Orlando has some very audacious clean energy goals. I believe they want to be 100% clean energy by 2050. Orlando Utilities Commission in particular is implementing a lot of renewable energy and looking at battery storage pilots. So this Orlando is really moving ahead with clean, resilient energy.
Now, when you talk about the Internet of Things, connected buildings, connected cars, even like Internet-enabled home appliances, there are some concerns about security, right? So how much of what you do is focused on making sure that somebody can't hack into these appliances and turn them into something that they shouldn't be?
Oh, yeah, we have a big focus on cybersecurity, but really that's why we sort of start with good planning and stakeholder alignment, because anything we can do to make a city smarter without having to use technology, it just helps you avoid those issues altogether.
Okay, so Mithal, I wonder if you could tell me what your thoughts are on the relevance of Orlando to this notion of building a smart city, because there may be some hurdles, right? Like, Orlando is fairly spread out. Does that pose a challenge if you're trying to think of a city that's trying to reinvent itself and be a smart and sustainable city?
Yeah, I do. And I think that Orlando is really trying to move forward. I mean, just with, one of their biggest areas of focus for the smart cities efforts, which they're getting a lot of funding for and winning a lot of proposals for, is focused on the mobility piece and trying to get that more integrated. And then also with regards to building codes and things like that, they're trying to focus more on building things properly and more of a walkability aspect. This first roundtable is focused on introducing this concept to the community and also looking at where there's opportunities for the development of this program and a more robust program. I mean, like Yogue was saying, you know, our goal is to help develop public and private partnerships between Central Florida and cities in India, as he had mentioned, the 100 Smart Cities Initiative there, and encouraging international collaboration, economic development, and job growth. And those topics will be handled amongst the participants, all of which are, again, public and private entities and stakeholders.
You know, one more thing I'd like to add. As Orlando is growing at a rapid clip, I think the statistic is about 1,000 people move into Central Florida, which is Orlando MSA, every week. As a result of that, we have to think about sustainable ways of managed growth. Transportation is definitely an issue, especially we're challenged with the fact that we have a bunch of lakes, environmentally sensitive lands, and we have to navigate those so that we don't impact our environment, because once the environment goes the wrong way, it's very hard to restore it.
So, I mean, if you think about a city, is it better to have, you know, a city where you go up rather than out? Because Orlando's kind of been built on this model of we can drive everywhere. You know, back when it was being conceived and built, it was the apex of the automobile as the means of getting around. But are we having to rethink that now and think about sort of more dense conurbation where people are living in more close proximity to each other, and maybe there isn't that pressure on environmentally sensitive lands or lakes or other things like that?
Absolutely. So both Orange County and City of Orlando are in the process of looking at how they can increase density in several areas.
Mm-hmm.
In Orange County, they've started with the iDrive Overlay District, wherein future development or redevelopment opportunities will be more dense, more walking-friendly, and so on. City of Orlando, I think, is also considering these options because going vertical may be a better solution than urban sprawl. We are also challenged with the urban services boundaries in Orange County and Orlando as relates to services such as water, wastewater, and mm-hmm. so on. So it's a fine balance that we have to look at, we meaning our government has to look at and make sure that things grow in the right way.
Because people look at Florida and they're like, there's land here, right? I want my quarter acre paradise. I want a backyard. I want a swimming pool. Is that maybe not the way to think about things, though, for the future?
Well, there's a demographic that likes that, and there's also a demographic now that prefers the density.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the eco boomers that prefer the urban lifestyle. And then you've got the...
Are you referring to the millennials?
Yeah, eco boomers are also known as the millennials. Mm-hmm. Actually, the eco boomers, they're the second largest generation in the U.S. now outside of the baby boomers.
I think they've surpassed it, is what I heard, that they're a larger population than the baby boomers.
Maybe that's a
but
good statistic.
But they're relevant.
And it sounds, Mithil, as though they're sort of more receptive to some of these ideas of urban density and sort of rethinking the way people get around and the like.
I will tell you that just like from the company that I work with, Eco Preserve, and what we do, and I mean, we go to all types of conferences. One of the biggest things that comes up from an HR standpoint is talking about how to keep millennials employed, how to retain them. And it's a different lifestyle. And it's all the things that Yogi mentioned. But I mean, this aspect of sustainability and this smart component, it's not an option. It's just an expectation that they have when they come into the workforce and what they want in their life. So mm-hmm. if you're not, as an organization, as a city, as a company, looking at those things or building around that, knowing that this is, you know, our largest generation yet, then you're going to be behind.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have a lot of unhappy people.
You know, the other thing that I'd like to add to this is the baby boomers actually are now empty nesters. And as they move up in age,
They're downsizing
mm-hmm. and they like items with less maintenance. So mm-hmm. to maintain a home, a yard, a pool, what have you, is a little bit more of a challenge.
If I could just come back to you for a moment, Mike Hess, picking up on some of the conversation about the generation that is now more interested in living in an urban setting rather than maybe the suburbs, the idea of empty nesting and downsizing, that presents a business opportunity, right, for companies like Panasonic and others.
Oh, it's a huge focus of ours. So we actually, being a Japanese company, space has been constrained in Japan for decades.
Right.
So we're actually bringing a lot of those solutions over to the U.S. right now. So we just opened a showroom in Denver, and part of that showroom is actually a micro apartment and showing off space management solutions that can make a 400 square foot apartment feel like it's 800 square foot.
And just thinking of that, I mean, places where real estate is really expensive, like San Francisco, there must be opportunities for companies to bring some of that tiny living, so to speak, philosophy and give people an option to live somewhere a little bit cheaper.
Absolutely. That's huge in San Francisco. We're actually working on a project in San Francisco, and it's all about workforce housing and creating smaller units. I mean, right now, the police, the firemen, a lot of folks that work in the community, they can't afford to live there.
Mm-hmm.
So as we start to figure out intelligent space management to make spaces that are smaller, more affordable, it allows people to come back and live in the community that they serve.
How do you make a small space feel bigger, though?
It's all about taking advantage of every cubic foot. So if you walk around your house, you'll see a lot of space that you never really touch.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really creating solutions that give you access to those spaces. It's also about, as you get into sort of an urban living environment, it's not just your unit. It's what are the sort of common areas and the amenities for the residents that that even though they only have their own small unit, they have these bigger, grander spaces that are sort of community spaces that they can share.
Mm-hmm. So some of these things are just, you know, the design of a building. But where does the smart technology come into that?
The smart technology comes into that really after you start to understand what those particular stakeholders or residents want. Everybody wants something a little bit different. So it differs in Japan versus what people want in the U.S. So really that comes down to just working with the developer, the owner of the city, and just understanding what level of technology are they looking for. If they want 100% clean, reliable energy and they want battery backup, then you can start to layer in those technologies. Methil was talking earlier about sensors on streetlights and sensors in buildings. So if they want it to be ultra safe, you can put in things like gunshot detection and have that sort of automatically close down or lock down a building if a sensor picks up on those things. So it's really just understanding what a particular user wants or needs out of their particular project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mike, I really liked how you started the conversation talking about the goal of planning, because I think some of the things that we see is that it's kind of like the latest new and shiny thing, and you're like, oh, I want that. It's like somebody who has a gold watch or whatever, or I want that and I want that, and people kind of forget about the plan or what the true intent and goal should be. And so I'm really glad that you brought that up, because that shiny piece sometimes leads to very unsuccessful and costly projects if you don't think about the goal and the business case right from the front.
But it sounds like you've got to get everybody involved, and that would be why, you're reaching out to local governments too, right?
Absolutely. There's both a private sector here, a public sector here. A lot of items that have moved forward with the government sector being challenged with the funding side of things have been in a public-private partnership format, as a result of which, we've got all these people that I previously mentioned at the table to engage in that roundtable discussion and share best practices, ideas, and bring people together.
Do you think people who live in Orlando are ready for this? Because the idea of living in a smaller space, it's a bit of a different mindset, right, from a 3,000-square-foot home, for example.
Absolutely. So that's a great point. From the 60s onwards, if you looked at the average home size up until our Great Recession, the home size grew. However, in the last 10 years, the home size has shrunk. So people are, open to that idea. I think it's a slow process, but people are, open to it.
And as there's some necessity driving it too, though, right, as well. Like, for example, home prices here in Orlando are going up fairly dramatically, so people kind of have to think about smaller spaces if they want to live somewhere affordable.
Absolutely. That's a great point you touched on, and that's the reality of the matter. So there's a cost balance, someone has to also take into consideration.
Yogh Malwani is the president of the Indian American Chamber of Commerce. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. And again, if I may, our website, www.iaccorlando.com, has all the information about this event, and we welcome everybody to join us on March 14th.
We're also joined by Methil Hall. She is on the leadership committee with the chamber. Thank you as well, Methil.
Thank you, Matthew.
And Mike Hess, vice president of Smart and Sustainable Buildings with Panasonic. He'll be one of the presenters at the conference. Thank you as well, Mike.
Thank you very much.
And you can find a link to the roundtable, including a list of presenters, at our website, wmfe.org/intersection. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection reporting. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. You can find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. We're on the NPR One app, and you can download the podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.